Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
We're doing this on Thursday and not Wednesday, which we tend to tape on Wednesdays, and Wednesdays have always been good on primary days. And so I was a little sad that I couldn't do it this Wednesday. I was moving it to Thursday, like, oh, everyone's going to be talking about Mississippi, and it's all going to be played out by Thursday. But I feel like on the right, the circular firing squad is just getting started.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think in this case, we may have benefited by waiting a day. There's so many elements to what happened in Mississippi, and I think we may have actually been aided by the benefit of some 24 hours to reflect on it.
So I just want to give you a broad question. Everyone made so much out of David Brat, a few weeks ago. But now that the primary season is largely over, do you have like a big picture thought? I mean, we've seen a whole bunch of primaries. For my take, it seems like there's been very few successful Tea Party revolts. I mean, really, it's just Brat. Most of the primary season's been pretty quiet. Whether from you or just sort of Washington in general, is there a sense that the Brat race was the anomaly, and the Tea Party really has not gained in strength, or does the Brat victory still have sort of disproportionate resonance, and people still are saying that that flag is something still to be feared in Washington?
Well, look, I think in both cases you have a case where clearly there is a grassroots anger on the right, and I think just because McDaniel lost in Mississippi doesn't mean you should discount that. And clearly, it was there with Brett. Ironically, the differences in Virginia, the Tea Party groups and the big names weren't really helping Brett. And I think actually he snuck under the radar. The key difference is that Cantor didn't see it coming and Cochran did. And obviously the primary was a wake-up call for Team Cochran, and they were able to right the ship and I think very quickly adapt and reinvent themselves and come up with a new strategy for
And
the
you had a great
runoff,
column
which
about
was
that, by the way. You had a column at the Week saying
yeah.
that the big lesson of the Cochran race, and this sort of goes, it's really not an ideological point. It kind of goes for anybody, any situation. You could always adapt. You could always adjust to changing circumstances and upend, soon to be outdated conventional wisdom.
I think that's actually the skill, and I don't know where I got this somewhere on Charlie Rose or something. Someone wrote a book, but I think this is like the skill of our time. It used to be that success was largely contingent on sort of figuring out what works and becoming very efficient at doing the same thing over and over and over again, and that was like the assembly line approach. But I think in the modern world, whether it's business, military, or politics, it seems like the ability to think on your feet and adapt very quickly to changing circumstances is maybe the best skill that you can have today. And I think that's what Cochran did. They figured out that they what was trying to do didn't work, and they came up with a new strategy, which was basically, there were a couple of a multi-pronged approach. One was we have to now make sure that Republicans who assumed we were going to win anyway, who didn't vote because they assumed we were going to win, now clearly we need to, they're going to see, and we need to turn them out. They should see that we're in trouble. The other was to woo, to expand the universe, to, if it was who can be most conservative, we can't beat McDaniel. We're not going to win that game within the confines of the Republican universe, primary universe, so we have to expand it. Let's turn this into a general election. And we can win that. And that, of course, is easier said than done, because history says that runoff elections are going to have lower turnout than primaries, and that the people who are likely to show up are the grassroots conservatives who are the most motivated, who will crawl through broken glass to vote for McDaniel. And Cochran said, okay, but that's a different paradigm. We're going to, when I say Cochran, somebody else, Haley Barbour, the NRSC, whoever, said, we're going to do something unconventional. The other thing, real quick, Bill, I think we learned when you compare this to the Eric Cantor race is that history, we should throw out history in the sense that, you know, history said that majority leaders don't lose primaries. And history said that incumbents who finish below 50% in primaries don't win runoffs. And in both cases, history was defied. And so I think that is, if there's something that we can tie those, what happened to Cantor and what happened to Cochran together, one lesson is that what a crazy year it is, and that conventional wisdom and history can be proven wrong.
Well, one point I want to make about that, I mean, there was all this punditry that, well, the runoff, the turnout for the runoff is going to be lower because turnout and runoffs is almost always lower. And you know, it's that kind of very superficial, you know, thumbnail wisdom, which I really loathe because it doesn't get to the underlying reasons why turnoff is usually lower. I mean, a typical runoff is, okay, you know, the law says you need 50% plus one to win outright. You have a field of, you know, seven people, a lot of also-rans, divvies up the vote. Someone gets 40%, someone gets 30%, and everything else scatters. There's some guy near the top who is pretty close to getting it. So there isn't seemingly a lot at stake with the election. The outcome seems to be more fait accompli. That keeps you staying home. Or another kind of scenario is, okay, there's some folks are crowded at the top. Maybe you got to get 29% to the 27%, but it's a party primary. There's not all that much difference between the candidates.
Or there's other races driving. I mean, if the primary race has other, you know, other elections driving people to the polls and the runoff is just one seat, then that would also explain lower turnout in a
runoff. But that was the case in this race too. That was one that was common. That it was a standalone race, nothing else driving turnout. But you know, in a race where you got two very similar candidates in a crowded field that make it to the runoff, the average voter will say it really doesn't make that big of a difference which one of these I choose because it's still going to be a relatively conservative Republican, so whatever. So here you have a situation where they were essentially a dead heat in the initial primary, and there was a pretty dramatic difference on a couple of key issues. So there seemingly was a lot at stake with this. So you could have foreseen that turnout would at least be a similar, if not more, because there was clearly a lot at stake with this race and a lot of attention driving it. So it was very, I think, forward-thinking of the Cochran campaign to say it is possible to expand this electorate. There is incentive for people to show up, and there's a case for us to make for them to show up.
Yeah, and I mean, well, yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the reason that conventional wisdom gets bandied about is that it usually is right. But Cochran dead doesn't happen much because it's harder. I mean, it's easier if you're the low-hanging fruit says people who vote are people who vote. And so we're going to target people who vote. And Democrats don't tend to vote in Republican primaries. So, you know, the theory goes that you start off with a universe of likely voters for whatever the race is, in this case, a primary or a runoff. Who are the likely voters? Well, people who are high propensity Republican primary voters, who voted in Republican primaries in the past, that's the universe you start with, and then you spend resources persuading them. Now, that is textbook, you know, campaign 101. If Cochran had done that, he would have lost, and he would have lost by about 10 points, at least. So Cochran said, we can't win by running a traditional campaign. We have to do something harder and unorthodox. And I think they clearly made the right call. It was really the only move they had if they wanted to win. It was an act of desperation, but necessity is the mother of invention. And I think it was aided by the fact that various factors, including the fact that Cochran had had a pretty good relationship with the African-American community going back decades. I think it was aided by the fact that McDaniel's rhetoric and persona harkened back to a Republican image that that I think would drive black turnout. There was a quote in the New York Times today, something to do with the fact that McDaniel wants to go back to the good old days, and for African Americans, the good old days weren't all that good. And so there were many factors playing into this, but at the end of the day, it was very interesting. And I, whether you like Cochran or not, and there's, you know, plenty of people were upset that Democrats would be determining or at least impacting who the nominee is. I think you have to applaud him for the logistical, strategic and logistical feat that they pulled off.
And, you know, we were talking about this before coming on. I had recalled that there was quote unquote walking around money that the Cochran campaign or affiliate with the Cochran campaign were paying African-American leaders to help whip out turnout in their communities, which has always been a bit of a controversial thing to do and not always talked about openly. So this was in the New York Times, you know, just 5 days ago, before the primary. Talking about the campaign's outreach to African Americans. The outreach campaign is taking many forms. The super PAC supporting Cochran, Mississippi Conservatives, is paying African American leaders, including Mr. Crudup, who I apologize, I just to make sure I get his affiliation right. Bishop Ronnie Crudup, pastor of the New Horizon Church International, paying Mr. Crudup to help lift black turnout on Tuesday, said Pete Perry, a Republican strategist here who is working for the group, working for the super PAC. Said Perry, quote, "We're working with a whole bunch of different folks, and Crudup is one of them." He declined to say how much Mississippi Conservatives was paying, but when asked whether it was in the five-figure range, he said, sure. So, you know, they were pretty open about that, and it certainly didn't hurt them in the African-American community they were doing that. I think there's a general understanding that, you know, it doesn't matter. I mean, you pay campaign workers. You pay staff. So as long as the message being delivered is considered on the level, the fact that there was payment involved, you know, didn't rub anybody the wrong way. And as you're saying, you know, the plain things McDaniel said were really rankled African-Americans. Cochran had a substantive message. I have delivered for the state and for the community. We have gotten money to schools. We've gotten money for infrastructure. We've helped supported jobs. This is and McDaniel has a fundamentally opposite ideology when it comes to that sort of thing. And so the message had resonance and it worked. And now they have McDaniel essentially crying foul. So it's like illegitimate that quote unquote liberal Democrats were in the primary, but as folks who may know, it's an open primary. They don't even have traditional primary registration in Mississippi. You don't have to register as a Democrat or Republican voter. So how would you deny? You can't just go to a black person show up to a Republican primary. You're not allowed to be here because there's no party registration involved. So, you know, a campaign has to realize the environment that you're in. And, you know, if McDaniel saw what Cochran was doing, you know, he might have figured out, what can I say to the African-American community? They're allowed to vote in this race. Maybe there's something I can do to show that what I want to do is going to help this community. But he didn't have that in his arsenal.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, if you're McDaniel, you basically want to keep the same universe that you had in the primary. All things being equal, I mean, you know, McDaniel would have won. And so, why change anything? Why mess around with the electorate or, you know, or whatever, the pool of voters? So this has created a real problem though, because now you have the sense that conservatives are angry and they feel like Cochran, in order to win, painted them as racists. And first some, I think that conservatives invited some of this and may have actually helped some of this. You had the Senate Conservatives Fund. There's a New York Times story a few days before the election where they were planning to deploy poll watchers in Mississippi, ostensibly to challenge Democrats who had voted in the primary, because if you had voted in the primary, you would not be eligible. But maybe that would also have the effect of discouraging turnout amongst a certain community. Now, the problem with that from an optics standpoint is the context that 50 years ago, almost, you know, exactly 50 years ago, was Freedom Summer, where three civil rights activists were murdered in Mississippi during a voter registration, African-American voter registration drive. And so that, who knows, I'm not on the ground. I don't know if that impacted this at all, helping drive African-American turnout. If conservatives might have just not really known the context or the history of that and inadvertently sort of played into it. And if there was a backlash, it's certainly possible. But in any event, there were some phone calls made and there were some flyers distributed to African-American communities implying that the Tea Partiers are trying to stop you from voting. It's unclear if this came from Cochran's campaign or if this was a setup put out by McDaniel supporters. You know, who knows? But conservatives that I'm interacting with are, and people like Mark Levin, national conservatives, are basically saying that the Republican establishment, in order to win, is painting Tea Partiers as racists. And as you can imagine, that leaves a very bad taste in the mouths of a lot of Tea Partiers and conservatives. Really nothing that angers them more than that, and I think rightly so. The only problem is, I don't know if it's true. And the other thing is that bad, I don't want to excuse it, but we remember, you know, the allegations that John McCain fathered an illegitimate black child and that were lodged against him in South Carolina in 2000, ostensibly by the Bush people. So these things happen on campaigns, not to excuse them, but they happen. So, and sometimes there are people who are freelancing. I mean, McDaniel certainly had people who were freelancing going into nursing homes for him. So it, was this ordered by Cochran's people? Was it a setup put out by McDaniel supporters to make Cochran look like he's playing the race card to thereby drive more Tea Party turnout? Or was it a Cochran supporter who was freelancing, you know, somebody that they hired who went to Kinko's, took it upon himself to go to Kinko's? And you know, we don't know. I don't think we know. Maybe somebody knows. Somebody knows. but that's right now there's a lot of bitterness and anger on the right. And this flyer has been put up on blogs and distributed. And the sense is that the Republican establishment is painting us as racists. And of course, there's outrage there.
Well, you know, we've talked about issues with conservatism and race a lot. And, you know, whatever the truth is as far as who was behind what, I think if I'm a Tea Partier, you know, I have to worry about what I can control. I can control my own actions, my own rhetoric, my own body language, my own set of issue positions. I can't control what other people are going to do. You know, people are going to play nasty when you get on the ground in politics. That, you know, whether it's from the top or bottom up, it's going to happen. So, what can you do to not give them the ammo to blow back in your face? And you know, here you have in Mississippi where they passed a voter ID law. They announced they're going to send poll watchers into polling booths to try to hold down the vote. And just so people who might not know about GOTV, I mean, all campaigns or good campaigns have poll watchers. But the positive role of the poll watcher is to boost your own turnout. You have your voter list. You know who you've identified as a supporter. You check as people come in to see who is voting. And then by midday, you can check your list and say, okay, I got all these supporters of mine that haven't shown up yet. My team's going to go call them and remind them to vote today and make sure they have a way to get to the polls. And there's a lot more upside to doing that than trying to stop people from voting, which we're not in the Jim Crow days anymore. You know, it's not that simple. Even when you have a voter ID law, it seems, and I grant you that, I think these voter ID laws are new and we haven't had enough data to fully assess the impact of these laws. But I think just anecdotally speaking, in the past couple of years, what example do we have of a voter ID law that has seemingly held down voter turnout in a way that has benefited a Republican or conservative candidate? I can't think of an example like that. I only know of examples where it's backfired. All right.
Well, let me jump in, Bill, because I tend to agree with you, and you're right. I mean, the sort of positive part of a poll watcher is to drag your people kicking and screaming to the polls, and if they haven't turned out, to harass them until they do. I'm not saying that, you know, derisively. I think you need to look that you've described pretty accurately what this looks like, the sort of worst, the bad optics. You've described, I think, very accurately the bad optics. But first I should point out that the Senate Conservatives Fund supposedly was deployed some poll watchers. They were not allowed to challenge voters unless they were deputized by the McDaniel campaign. So each campaign can assign people who are allowed to challenge. I think there is a good argument. I don't know that I agree, but there is a good argument that Republicans ought to be deciding Republican nominees. Now, the key to that is to change the rules. I mean, Mississippi has an open primary, and if you don't want people who aren't loyal Republicans voting, then you need to have like some sort of a party registration or something, you know, and other states do that. I'm from Maryland, and at least when I lived in Maryland, you had to be a registered Republican to vote in Republican primaries. In Virginia, where I live now, it's an open primary, and if you don't like the rules, you know, presumably they can be changed. It does make sense that if you knew, and very clearly Cochran had telegraphed that he was going to be attempting to expand the electorate and to turn out voters, it's benign and rational to have people there challenging anybody who already voted, who might have voted in a Democratic primary, to prevent them from voting again. I mean, that's benign, and that is rational. I think the problem is the optics. And part of this is, how do you, you know, there are basically two ways that you can tell who's a Democrat and who's not, right? One is you stand, when the person checks in and they say their name, you could presumably look at a list and say, oh, Matt Lewis is a red, you know, Matt Lewis has voted or hasn't voted in any Republican primaries, or he's voted in the last three Democratic primaries, so we're going to challenge him. He's already voted in this Democratic primary. The other is, he looks like a Democrat. And therein lies the problem. So I think that, you know, you could argue that there were bad motives here, or you could argue that it's a case of an understandable desire to not allow Democrats to determine who the next Republican nominee is, but potentially bad optics and politically unwise based on the optics.
Well, and you got to play by the rules of the game as they are. The rules of the game are open primary, You have to work with what you have. And if I may segue to a different aspect of this, I mean, Tea Partiers should worry that their message seems to have a ceiling of how far it can go. I mean, if your message can't go beyond this slice of the Republican electorate, you know, that doesn't bode very well for the general election, does it?
Well, look, I think that's a very interesting point, and it doesn't at the micro level in Mississippi. I'm not too, you know, it doesn't, you know, but I think this is at large a bigger issue. I mean, never mind Mississippi. I mean, whether it's think of immigration reform, okay? I hate to go on this again because we've spent so much time talking about it and everybody knows my position on it. But essentially, if you really dig into the opposition to immigration, it's hard not to come up with a couple of conclusions. One being, these people, whether it's because of something innate or because of the country they come from, but these people are not capable of winning over. The conservative message cannot appeal to them. They're either, you know, I think on the far extremes, the sense it's a genetic thing, which is horrific, or maybe it's just a cultural thing. But there's a sense, and my take has always been, if conservative philosophy can't win over people, that is a horrible concession, and that's a horrible.
I don't think you have to deal with that far. I don't think you have to draw the conclusion that conservatism writ large, in any permutation, is a sure loser. Period. I think that wildly overinterpreting the results here. But more narrowly, I mean, you had in Mississippi, you know, the closing ad of the campaign, which is not a Cochran campaign ad per se. It was actually U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but it was quote unquote wall to wall in Mississippi, huge ad by starring Brett Favre, and the text of the ad itself doesn't have any kind of nod to Tea Party conservatism. You know, the sole policy argument of the speech is whether it's delivering on funds for our schools, Thad Cochran delivers just like he did with Katrina. Forgive me for not having the exact quote in front of me. But essentially, the message was Thad Cochran brought home the bacon for education and disaster relief. That was it. That was the nut of the argument.
Right.
And as Cochran would say, and folks like Rick Santorum have said, it's not liberal per se for a democratically elected member of Congress to have a large say in how your taxpayer dollars get directed. We want people in Congress saying this money should go here and not over there, as opposed to ceding all the power to the executive branch to make all those decisions. That was a conservative argument for quote-unquote earmarks that has been shunted to the side in the past few years, but Cochran embraced it directly in this campaign.
Yeah.
He had evidence to show in Mississippi, like, here's what I built. Look at these research centers. Look at these schools. Look at this infrastructure. This has mattered in Mississippi. And McDaniel was going around saying that federal in schools is unconstitutional. And getting twisted up in knots on what it was going to mean for military bases in Mississippi. So you got to worry, I think, if you're a Tea Party, this very narrow, and I would say pretty extreme concept of government spending reform doesn't have a lot of reach if you can't get beyond, you know, yes, crossover votes put Cochran over the top, but he still had, you know, 130,000 Republican votes. It was still majority Republican votes he won. It wasn't just African-American Democrats. You only had about, a little more than half of the Republican electorate side with the McDaniel message in Mississippi, of all places. That's a little, I think that at least warrants some introspection how that message can be recalibrated.
Well, first, going back to race real quick, I mean, just the final note I would put on it would be, if Republicans can only win white people, white men especially, that's a huge problem. And that's also an indictment on the ideas and the salesmanship of those ideas. But speaking to what you just said about the Brett Favre ad, I think you you can draw larger conclusions to it. But first, I just want to talk about the strategic sort of sagacity of Cochrane, which was, you're saying that this ad's remarkable, but it's completely logical. I think Cochrane's people simply concluded, if you are a Tea Party person who like really cares about those issues, free market fiscal conservatism or whatever, you're voting McDaniel. You're not voting for us. And it would have been a huge mistake for Cochrane to try to out McDaniel. And so this goes back to the beginning of our conversation where he said, we're going to go the other direction. And, there's this political maxim called hang a lantern on your problem. Instead of running away from the sort of bringing home the bacon thing, Cochrane, I think, wisely ran to it and said, yeah, you know what? Look, Cochrane said this. If you want somebody who's going to, cut spending and go to Washington and fight Democrats, then go ahead and vote for McDaniel. But if you want someone who's going to, bring home bridges and whatever, largesse, and who, then vote for me. I think it was a very smart political move, putting aside the larger implications that I think you're more interested in, which is the fact that, yes, I think there's a constituency for people. And until recently, there were plenty of hypocritical Republicans who, think of in the South, especially in the Midwest, think of Mike Huckabee. These are big government Christian conservatives. It's not a weird thing. There is a constituency and there is a sort of movement of Mike Huckabees who are people who, I can identify with this. Some of my family sort of, coming out of the Depression, their philosophy, it's basically, and I have a family member recently, I asked them, this is true, 90 years old, an in-law, who was the best president of your lifetime? Answer, FDR. Who was the worst president of your lifetime? Answer, Barack Obama. And there is still a lot of sort of good old boy folks out there who, it's like, man, we got to have God, go to church, got our guns, but FDR helped us through the hard times, and we need government. This is not an inconsequential group. They're largely forgotten. I think Rick Santorum, I've mentioned Huckabee, I think Santorum also could have appealed to this populist strain, but I think he just didn't do it.
He has other issues. But shouldn't. Most conservatives, most sane conservatives, don't say or at least don't really believe that all spending is bad. That our budget should be zero. that's not a rational position. The general conservative argument is that your government should be limited. Money shouldn't be wasted. Let's focus on what's effective. And maybe our view of what's effective is more limited than what a liberal might say. You don't zero out everything. That's nuts. And you might be able to rail against spending in the abstract and get away with it, but whenever we see these issues get really challenged with some hard facts on the ground, that more absolutist position, usually crumbles. It crumbles in the government shutdown debates. It doesn't succeed in turning around public opinion towards holding the line and shunning government to make sure we hack government to bits. That doesn't work. And when you got a guy and he's backed up with some, you know, pretty influential and well-moneyed allies to make the case that this money has directly helped us, it's not money that's been wasted, that argument doesn't fly. The anti-spending argument doesn't fly. And it doesn't mean you have to abandon cutting spending. It doesn't mean you have to abandon deficit reduction. It just means you got to be a little more refined in how you approach the issue.
So, Bill, while we've been talking about this election, there have been a couple of Supreme Court decisions handed down.
Oh, really? I've not been following my Twitter feed.
Yeah, so you have the Supreme Court slightly curtails president's recess appointment power.
Slightly.
That's the week. Basically, I think it allows the Senate to say when they're in session. But, you know, again, we've been talking, so I've been monitoring. Also, apparently, they struck down a distance that abortion protesters have to be away. This is AP breaking. Supreme Court voids 35-foot protest free zone outside Massachusetts abortion clinics. So those are the two big stories. The Hobby Lobby case not decided today. That's the big one I think everyone's waiting on.
But no Hobby Lobby?
Not Hobby Lobby today. I guess it's Monday maybe? That it might.
Now, my understanding with the recess appointment thing, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's still an interesting constitutional question whether or not the president had the recess power when the Senate was in kind of pro forma session. But since, and so the fear before was that if Obama's recess appointments for the Consumer Financial Protection Board and for the National Labor Relations Board were nullified, it would also nullify all of the rulemaking that they did during that time. But because last year, McCain brokered a compromise which allowed those recess appointments to be traditionally confirmed, that fear was taken off the table. Even if the recess appointments got nullified in the past, the same people are in there now, confirmed through traditional means, and they can just redo what they did before. That's my understanding as far as the limited practical impact of the potential of that ruling, but having not read the opinion or being ignorant, maybe somebody will correct me in the comments. That's my understanding.
Yeah, I'm guessing it was narrowly. It won't overturn anything. I wrote about this a while ago. They were considering three questions: when does the Senate go to recess? Does the vacancy have to literally occur during the recess? So not just the appointment, but does the vacancy have to occur during the recess? And do pro forma meetings held every 3 days in order to game the system and avoid going on recess constitute being in session? In our view, the pro forma sessions count as sessions, not as periods of recess. We hold that for purposes of the recess appointments clause, the Senate is in session when it says it is. Under its own, contains the capacity to transact Senate business. The Senate met that standard here. So it sounds like it's going to make it for a president recess, as long as the Senate is sort of pretending that they're in session. So we'll see. Who actually know what they're talking about. Who weren't just monitoring Twitter, what they say about it. But anyway, interesting. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I want to bring up a different topic, if I may. So there's been a lot of talk about Hillary having a awkward book rollout tour. Even the book sales in the second week are dropping, so there's some question how big her base is. But what was interesting to me this week is, you know, Bernie Sanders gave an interview to Howard Feinman at the Huffington Post, where, I mean, he really sounds like he's running. You know, that he's not just musing about it, that he's actually doing the things to prepare for a race and has mapped out what his strategy is going to be. Just to give you a sense of what his quote, because one of the things he's been doing a bit of a listening tour, and he had said, he's an independent of the caucus of the Democrats. He's always been very proud of not being in a party per se, and so he was a little reluctant to run a Democratic primary. But he also said he didn't want to be a Ralph Nader. He didn't want to go in as a third party and split the left and elect a conservative Republican. So how was he going to finesse that? And so now he has an answer. So he told Howard Feinman, I want to see what kind of response I get when he was touring around. He said, so far it's been very good. And so he says he is thinking of running in the primaries against Hillary as a, quote-unquote, independent Democrat. Quote, that would mean running in the Democratic primaries and caucuses, but acknowledging that I am an independent and have won every election I have run as an independent. That says to me that he's pretty much in. I mean, I know it's not the same thing as an announcement, but he's pretty far along in his thinking, and he's not saying, here's what I need to figure out so I won't do it. You know, he's not really raising the condition of not doing it. His condition always was, I'm not going to do it if nobody else does it. So, barring someone else doing it and say, okay, I don't have to be so busy, I can take a break. But it basically suggests there is going to be a primary. It's near certain that there will be a primary. And, Hillary's got to prepare for that if she isn't already. I think we can end the whole notion that there's going to be a coronation. Now, it may be Hillary has a very easy time dispatching of Sanders. I'm not arguing that's going to be a nail biter here. But it certainly is going to raise a lot of issues. These progressive, populist economic issues that are in Sanders' wheelhouse. That's what, I mean, he's running to put these on the front burner, and he's actually pretty careful in saying that he's not, I mean, he doesn't say a lot of negative things about Hillary. He's not like Brian Schweitzer, who's been much more personal in his criticism. You know, he says, love in the Post, in terms of Hillary, I respect her, I've known her, I like her, so I'm not running to attack. So no, I'm not running to attack Hillary Clinton. Again, that pretty much sounds like he is running. I'm running to talk about the issues that impact the working class of this country and the middle class. I'm running. I just think that this is going to be a major element of 2016 that I don't think people have fully gotten their arms around yet.
Yes, I think that there are a lot of incentives for people to run. And the interesting thing is, let me ask you, Bill, to sort of think this through. The number of people that run, the way that they run, what is sort of the best case scenario? If Hillary's not going to get a clear shot, and maybe she shouldn't even, maybe it's good form a challenge. What sort of, is it bad if a whole bunch of people get in? How could this play out?
Well, I mean, interesting that if Bernie jumps in first, and he jumps in kind of safely in that he's not pledging a scorched earth campaign to destroy Hillary, so that's not going to ruffle as many feathers. But once one person jumps in the pool, it becomes a lot easier for other people to jump in because you won't get tagged as being, the mean jerk that is getting in the way of the historic Hillary Clinton candidacy. You know, Martin O'Malley, who's the governor of Maryland, who is kind of bland and kind of technocratic and hasn't, been getting a lot of attention outside of people who follow the stuff way too closely. Some people question whether he really would go mano a mano with Hillary. Well, if Bernie's in, it's not mano a mano. So why not jump in? Why not raise your national profile?
So you think that if someone like Bernie gets in, that may be there for other people to get in without being like,
absolutely.
Okay. That's interesting.
Right. So you won't be blamed for ruining Hillary's good time. And at the same time, you know, let's say you're Martin O'Malley and you know you're not going to win, but you really want to be vice president. Well, maybe you'll take some shots at Bernie along the way. You know, maybe you'll make this more of a free for all, and that might get you accused of being a stalking horse for Hillary or whatnot. But why do you care if it puts you into her good stead? Maybe you throw a few lobs towards Hillary just to make it interesting and keep people on their toes. And of course, we know Brian Schweitzer could also run also. And you know, maybe other folks will be inclined to jump in, knowing that you know the water's warm. So it seems increasingly likely that you'll have at least one, if not more. But you know, neither O'Malley or Sanders, you know, Schweitzer's different, but neither O'Malley or Sanders would go at Hillary hard. So. It's certainly not something that Hillary should be afraid of. It's certainly manageable for her part, but it requires a little bit of thinking. You know, you're going to get pushed on elements of Bill Clinton's presidency that the populist left does not like. The financial deregulation, NAFTA, some trades that were made for capital gains tax cuts. I mean, Clinton has defended these as, you know, simply horse trading to get other things that they wanted. Welfare reform. You know, she's going to have answers for these things, and I'm not saying she can't. But it's a choice. Do you hug Bill hard all the way through, or do you strategically distance yourself when possible? You know, she backed away from NAFTA in 2008, so she has some practice at adjusting.
Well, this also, This also, okay. Let's say that Sanders gets in and runs hard against her, and that opens the door to O'Malley getting in, because he can say, "Hey, I'm not the first. It's already people." And then let's say Hillary does start to stumble. Does that open the door for an Elizabeth Warren or somebody to say, "I wasn't going to get in. I was, but now it's very clear that you know, Hillary may be vulnerable, stretch, because Hillary's so, you know, almost it's a coronation almost. But I mean, isn't there a danger that it's a slippery slope sort of thing where like one person leads to two, which leads to." I don't know what you think, Bill, but she's had a very bad couple, 2 or 3 weeks. And if it were to continue, I mean, there does come a point where people say, maybe she's not the one.
Well, I'm not predicting that Warren would jump in. I just don't really believe it's what she wants. But to that point, I mean, this is what happened in 68, right? You know, Eugene McCarthy, you know, goes in as the long shot and roughs LBJ up early. And all of a sudden, he doesn't look inevitable anymore to be renominated. And then Robert F. Kennedy jumps in,
right,
seeing that there's an opening for him. You know, and you know, Hillary is not the smoothest candidate. She made her gaffes in 2008, which punctured her own inevitability, particularly on immigration. She got kind of twisted around on that in one of the early debates, and that, you know, sort of began her decline, and she was a bit rusty on a couple things coming out of this book tour. So yeah, you're still gonna have people. Maybe not just Elizabeth Warren, but maybe say Andrew Cuomo, who's not coming at it from the left, but coming at it from more of the business friendly wing of the party.
Look, I think you found your column hook. The 1968 historical analogy is good, and by the way, don't forget, she compared herself when she ran against Barack Obama in 2008 to Lyndon Johnson,
right,
saying that it wasn't MLK that got civil rights passed. It took leadership from Lyndon Johnson. So maybe that's an apt analogy. And I think your column for this week is basically now written. Plays right into your strength.
Now, outside of politics, you have abandoned your love of football temporarily in favor of football.
In favor of football. well, first of all, there are people who are not happy about this. And Coulter has a piece up attacking. I don't know if she's like re-upping it or if it's new, but attacking football, attacking soccer. You have to forgive me, Bill. I'm so cosmopolitan and international that I have to. I know maybe I just have to call it soccer for them. I'm practicava con la raza. So,
well, as you know, in Australia, football is also rules football, so they use soccer too. So you're not just being provincial, saying yeah. Soccer. Internationally, soccer is used.
I do it for the rubes out there who may be watching. It could also be Aussies who need help with this. But no, yeah, she goes to talk about how it's real American sports are individual, right? You know, you strike out and you're to blame, or you fumble the ball. Supposedly in soccer, she claims that's not really the case. She also doesn't like the fact that other American sports require hands and opposable thumbs, and apparently football does not. I have gotten, I think, caught up a little bit in the World Cup. Go to a party at noon, a noon party, to watch America defeat Germany, which, if it happens, I think we'll do nothing but continue this American zeit of liking soccer. I attribute a lot of it to metric system. People have been shoving this down our throats for 30 or 40 years. We're all going to have to get the metric system. We're all going to be playing soccer. I think it finally caught on because of HDTV. And big TV, and it's H now for me. So I think maybe Twitter helps. I don't know. But anyway, I've been enjoying it. And I also think, Bill Simmons over at Grantland was saying that, Americans have been pissed off about the 2-2 tie the other day against Portugal. And I disagree. The thing I like about soccer is that I'm not that invested in it. I don't need to be. I got to worry about the Redskins. I got the Orioles. I got the Nats. I mean, and once a lot of pressure to being a real fan. There are expectations. And I compare soccer to like a fling, like a vacation. Soccer knows what this is. Soccer doesn't expect anything from me, and I don't expect anything from it except for 90 minutes of really hot action. And and by the way, speaking of which, apparently, I forget whether it was Slate or Salon, but there was some sort of lefty site arguing that it's okay to objectify male soccer players for some reason. whatever does it for you, I'm fine with it. I don't care. It's obviously not why I'm watching. But I do compare it to a fling. It's fun. I don't need to I'm not going to compare. I'm not going to care 2 months from now about soccer. I'm okay with that. This is the world to it. It's fun. It is what it is. Enjoying watching this sport. And I'm okay with that. I don't think we need more. I think it is what it is, and I'm happy with it. I'm going to go watch it today at lunch.
I want to get back to this.
And if we lose to Germany, and if we were to fail to advance, then the love affair is over.
I want to get, as much as I'm interested in your your sports promiscuity.
I want to get to this
Ann Coulter thing, which I didn't know about, and I'm looking at the full quote now. So she writes, "Any growing interest in soccer can only be a sign of the nation's moral decay. Individual achievement is not a big factor in soccer. In a real sport, players fumble passes, throw bricks, and drop fly balls all in front of a crowd. When baseball players strike out, they're standing alone at the plate. But there's also individual glory in home runs, touchdowns, and slam dunks. In soccer, the blame is dispersed and almost no one scores anyway. There are no heroes, no losers, no accountability, and no child's fragile self-esteem is bruised." I mean, as the resident sports expert of the DMZ, Matt, isn't that just factually wrong from top to bottom?
I'm not an expert in soccer, but I would say every sport.
But other sports are team sports. Soccer's not the only team sport in the world.
Every sport's unique. I mean, the great George Carlin baseball, baseball versus football, seen this? Yeah. I mean, it's famous. And,
I've seen baseball and football, sure.
In football, you get a penalty. In baseball...
football is an immensely collectivist sport. There's all sorts of working parts people have to work together. That's not a strictly individual glory sport. And soccer...
Yeah, and in soccer, I mean, if you're a goalie and you... If you're a goalie from... You could die! You could be killed when you go back, so...
Like Pele, Beckham, Ronaldo. I mean, there's all sorts of individual heroes in soccer. I mean, like any team sport, they have individual heroes. They're totally parallel to us every single way. It makes no sense.
Yeah. I'm a traditionalist. But it's a game. And it's fun, and why not embrace it? I mean, I don't think there's any threat that it's going to replace American football anytime soon. But I don't know. Like, how much of this is just her being a provocateur?
I mean, it sort of gets to what the weirdness of talk show conservatism, and maybe going back to Chris McDaniel, this obsession with finding things to complain about
We're talking about it.
Well, it may be good for clicks and for ratings, but it seems pretty terrible for, trying to be seen as a serious governing party. Does it take you, forgive me if I'm belaboring the argument too much, but is there something to this kind of constant whining? That you just become unmoored.
Well, it's a matter of incentives. It's an Ann Coulter's incentive to write these kind of things and to make these arguments. And it gets people like us talking about it. But it simultaneously hurts the conservative movement, in my opinion. It's the tragedy of the commons kind of thing. It's in her incentive to sort of get this, take this resource of time and buzz, but it collectively, it is in everyone's sort of worst interest. I mean, actually, it's not the tragedy of the commons, but it's some game theory. It's all about incentives. I mean, she benefits from this, but I think, look, maybe this plays into her argument. Look, I'm arguing that politics is like soccer, and she's arguing that it's like baseball. And she is hitting a home run in terms of clicks and views. So she's maybe getting the individual glory, but maybe she should have bunted or walked. She is seizing the individual glory here, but maybe not helping the team actually win the game.
Well, perhaps we should end it on that note, sir.
Weird sports analogies. I can do them all day. Although I'm not sure when hitting home runs ever bad, but you get my point.
Yes.
She's getting the personal, she's getting something out of it, but collectively, I think it hurts. I think that soccer is not inherently evil. And so I'll be watching America. And by the way, how about this? How about some patriotism? How about rooting for America to beat the Hun? That's what I'm pulling for.
Well, it's always good to talk to you, Matt Lewis.
Always good talking to you, Bill Scheer. Check us out on Twitter at DMZ Show and find us on Facebook, also /DMZ Show.
Till next week.
Stay classy, Mississippi.